This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. I actually have to read that line. I often forget who I am. But today, I'm talking with the legendary Peter Begg. He's the cartoonist who is behind Hate, one of the underground comic series that defined alternative culture in the 90s when being alternative really meant something. And for almost 20 years now, he's been a contributing artist or writer, whatever we want to call it, to Reason, where his comic essays have won awards while delighting and infuriating tens of thousands of readers and critics and, you know, politicians. A decade ago, he published a great anthology of his Reason work, which is still available from Fantagraphics. It's called Everyone is Stupid Except for Me and Other Astute Observations, A Decade's Worth of Cartoon Reporting for Reason Magazine. And in the newest issue of Reason, the one that's out now, and if you're a subscriber, you would already have it and you could read the full thing online. It's $15 a year to subscribe. Please subscribe to Reason. But he's got a great piece up called Immigration Grunts, The Poor Slobs Who Try to Help the Poor Slobs Trapped in Detention Hell. We're going to talk about that today on the podcast. We're going to talk about a series of cartoon biographies of women such as Margaret Sanger and Zora Neale Hurston and Rose Wilder Lane. He's got a big book on her coming out in a month. How comics have changed over the years and what it's like to be an underground artist who is also a libertarian. Of all things. Peter, thanks for talking.
No, thanks for having me. It's always a delight to talk to you, Nick.
Let's describe the new strip in Reason, Immigration Grunts. And there's two main, there's the immigrants or the people who are seeking refugee status or asylee status. They're in there, but there's these two groups that have differing, that are trying to help, that have differing approaches. But, you know, do a thumbnail summary of Immigration Grunts.
Well, I currently live in Tacoma, just down the road from Seattle, Washington, and Tacoma is the home of a very large immigration detention center, and there's frequently protests outside of it. So I swung by just thinking I'd see some protests, because they happen pretty often, but on this particular day, there wasn't. Started talking to these old people, old white conservative Christian people who help out the families of the detainees, giving them snacks and giving stuffed animals and treats to their kids.
Do they preach as well?
I didn't see them preach.
Okay, good.
There'd just be a little sign saying we're from, whatever, Presbyterian church or mm-hmm. Methodist church. But that led to me, through them, I met this organization that I talk about mostly in this strip that we're talking about. It's called Aid Northwest. And they simply were responding to what was literally a humanitarian crisis in Tacoma, where when a detainee is released, either on bond or is given asylum, they just walk out the door. And they might have been picked up like in Texas and just have a short sleeve shirt. So they literally are just walking around Tacoma, sometimes not speaking English, having no idea where they are, how to get to where they were last. So this organization of locals, mostly old retired people, they started up just to help them out, yeah. Help them get bus tickets and winter coats. And I was very impressed with the work these people do. And I became a volunteer for them. I do work, do stuff for them occasionally, primarily going into the jail just to simply talk to some of the detainees. Mm-hmm. The detainees will just say, I just want to talk to somebody that's not in here, just talk to somebody on the outside. And sometimes it literally is just to shoot the shit. But this one person I talked to is an Iraqi, and he worked very closely with the U.S. Air Force during the Iraq invasion. He wound up, our military brought him over here, then Obama changed policy, whatever department or project he was working on got discontinued, and they tried to send him back to Iraq, where he would have, without a doubt, have gotten killed.
Wow.
So he's been here illegally ever since. So here's this guy that was like, did everything he could for the U.S., and now he's sitting in this jail, just sitting in this box, and he has no idea when he's going to get out.
So is he, he's applying for refugee status or asylum or something like that?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Or so he's been in the United States for over 10 years. He's been here for quite a while and, had a job, had a girlfriend. So yeah, it's just it's just amazing that they won't let him stay.
So so the group, you know, there's the one group, Aid Northwest, and then what is the other group? Because you also encounter a different set of people who are also, you know, in their way, they're trying to reform the system or protest the status quo.
They are. That group, they call themselves the Northwest Detention Center Resistance Movement. Right. And it's very much revolves around this one woman that I drew, Maru. What was her name? Maru Mora Villapando. And she's a... she's a communist. And... And she's very self-aggrandized.
You know, isn't it, don't you hesitate, don't you, when you're actually describing a literal communist? When you say, oh, well, she's a communist, because you're not saying, like, she's a commie, she votes for the Democratic Party. It's like she is literally a communist.
Yes, yeah. And she didn't call herself that, but just everything that she says and believes, you know. And she, you know, of course, a lot of what she's preaching sounds, in the short run, is anarchistic.
Right.
You know, she's all about, let's totally mess up the system, let's block the streets. She works with Antifa, or so she claims. Mm-hmm. I always wonder, with the strip, she talked about how Antifa does what she tells them to do.
I have it on semi-good authority that it is pronounced Antifa.
Antifa, right.
But, you don't want to get on the wrong side of them. And also, who am I to enforce pronunciation of an anarchistic group, right? A group's name.
That's true. And well, also, I couldn't wait to put that in the strip, because I when she said that, I kept wondering, does Antifa know that?
Yeah.
They believe that, and they just do what she tells them to do. And I actually, in the strip, I went very easy on her, because I just wanted to get, didn't have a lot of space. It's just a 4-page strip. Really just wanted to get to the nuts and bolts of what she was all about, why she's at odds with Aid Northwest, the other organization. She does have a point that I agree with Aid Northwest, which is she calls them enablers. She says with ICE and these private prisons and with, you know, the Trump administration, with all the stuff they're doing, Aid Northwest is making it easier for them to get away with it. They're like, they're trying to help remove this humanitarian crisis. She'd rather everybody would see the humanitarian crisis and everybody go nuts.
God, that's a classic dynamic, right? Of, do you reform a system, or do you try to make it as bad as possible to force a quick transition, or do you try and be more humane and kind of gradual or something?
Right. And to the people at Aid Northwest, they would say, when I brought this up with them, they'd say, you know what? Technically, yeah, we agree. We are quote unquote enablers. But they said we couldn't do nothing. We just simply could not do nothing.
Right.
And they maintain relationships with all these immigrants and refugees. Mm-hmm. They house them for as long as they can afford to. And if they have a room, they try to help them get jobs. They try to help them in every way that they can and frequently become good friends with them. They're all like all these refugees and illegal immigrants that I met there are all really nice, smart, resourceful people. This woman, the Maru, she said a lot of things I didn't put in the strip, mainly because, you know, I wish her some success as far as like getting rid of these detention centers. And, you know, she wants to get rid of ICE, which that would be wonderful. I don't think that's going to happen because government agencies never go away ever. But she, like, for example, and I was really tempted to put this in the strip, when she was criticizing Aid Northwest, she called them, she said, there are a bunch of old white ladies who have a white savior complex. Just stuff that just drives me up the wall. She was an asshole. and she got a lot of her facts very wrong. I didn't correct her on any of them, but she said a lot of things that just weren't true. She also said that she doesn't care if like this detention center is closed, even though it's the best one. Because she said that the detainees don't care. The ones that she talks to and work with, they don't care if there's these people on the outside that are looking for winter coats for them. And they don't care if they see their families, which is utterly insane.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? The detainees you talked to, they told you that they don't care if they see their families? She goes, no. No, they just want this whole place burnt down, burn it to the ground. Yeah. It's like, that is such a lie. That's all they talk about when I talk to them. All they care about is their families. That's what they talk about incessantly. You know, it's like that's the biggest punishment that they're experiencing is being away from their own families.
You know, how do you choose the topics for, you know, I mean, and again, it's 10 or it's almost 20 years since you've been drawing for a reason, particularly the extended 4 or 6 page comic essays, you typically built around reporting or research. How do you generate your topics for that?
Well, there's two factors that go into it. One is a subject that interests me, but also I think of visuals. I always think with this, I need something to draw. It's a comic strip. Mm-hmm. So again, that's why I went to this detention center. I was hoping to see a big, crazy, rowdy protest because it's something I could draw. So I thought maybe that could be a hook. And just simply being able to draw something like that. Yeah. Eventually I did see protests. I drew just a one panel. It was pretty, it was very peaceful and just the usual marching back and forth and chanting. So that's something. When you were the editor, I remember you and I used to do a lot of back and forth. Mm-hmm. I would be throwing all kinds of ideas at you and you would throw ideas at me.
I have absolutely no memories of this. When I became editor at large, I had parts of my brain surgically removed, but I'll take your word for it.
And then when Matt replaced you, the relationship was more like I would pitch an idea. I'd have to wait for months and then he'd write.
Well,
okay.
Come on. Now this is not a time to settle scores, right? So, well, your relatively recent essays, and by that, I mean, this was in 2016, I believe, but Reason went on a trip. We sponsored a trip to Havana, Cuba that you went on. What were your memories of that trip? And the strip was called something like Let's Ruin Cuba. What are your memories of the Havana excursion?
Well, we weren't there very long. No. Was it like 4 days maybe?
I think so. Yeah.
It would have been great to get more into like the outer neighborhoods of Havana or even out of Havana entirely to see probably what was more depressing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of what we saw was disgusting.
Right.
It was a dump. The place was a dump. But we were at the most touristy part of the town. We were at the nicest part of.
Yeah. And, you know, since then, I don't know if you've followed these stories, but, it was evident there, buildings in Havana are literally crumbling because, they're in a salt air environment and they don't have, they don't have spare money for maintenance or upkeep. And I mean, the buildings are literally kind of collapsing. And that, in a weird way, was part of the charm of Havana is that it's moldering. It's slowly dissolving in front of, it has that feel of a ruin, but which is obviously tragic.
So many people are charmed by all the old American cars, too. But, and that, it makes for a nice visual. But, those cars are terrible gas guzzlers and they require endless maintenance. So for the Cubans, I'm sure 99% of them would be like, I'd love to trade this.
Yeah, Ford Fiesta, I would be like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of a Duesenberg or something like that, gets 2 miles to the gallon and has a carburetor,
Yeah. And keeping those cars running, that must take up all of their time. The guys that drive those cars, they must be, when they're not driving it, they must be. And how on earth do they replace the carburetors?
Yeah. It's a sign of how inventive and resourceful people can be. And I mean, because we had great meals and, the music is great and, it's a really interesting, lively place, but it's starving, literally and figuratively. Tell me a bit about, while we're talking about politics here or kind of geopolitics, can you describe your politics and how you got them?
Well, I always was a libertarian by nature, just simply having conversations, talking about what's happening in the news with my parents.
You were born in the late 50s, so this you're talking about, this is, in the 70s,
late 60s, early 70s. Yeah.
So there's really nothing going on. There's nothing in the news. There's no kind of, everything is smooth sailing. There's really, you just have a lot of time to talk with your parents. Yeah.
That's right. And I would ask them their take on whatever was in the, gay rights and women's rights and legalizing abortion, and
Vietnam.
And I would be surprised with some of these things that it was a debate. Like, I remember my parents got, they blanched, they both cringed and looked at each other when I asked them, what is gay mean? What do they mean by gay rights? And they were like, oh, just because they didn't want to, you know, get into
to talk about it. It might have meant that you would turn out gay. I mean, the gayness has that power, right?
I was asking about them because of the rights. And so I was like, so these people are getting arrested just for that? Really? Yeah. So that's a thing that really happens. I would just be flabbergasted that anybody on earth thought that that was the right thing to do, is to make gay people suffer for any reason. And I would ask my parents about something like that. Mm-hmm. And of course they never even thought about that until people started protesting, you know. Prior to that, they would never even think about, oh, isn't that a shame? Isn't that terrible?
Right.
Which is what most people did. So it'd always be like things like that where I would always be shocked that anybody was not always on the side of freedom. And, you know,
do you have siblings, and are they similarly disposed towards freedom or libertarianism, or are you just, you're obviously adopted or something, or your mother was taking a lot of pills during her pregnancy with you or something?
Well, my father was what they used to call a Northeast or Rockefeller Republican. Okay. So he actually was not thrilled with, for example, Ronald Reagan, just because he didn't like the way Reagan, his relationship with like the religious right, who my father thought, they used to call them cavemen. Mm-hmm. And my mother's by nature was very liberal, you know, a good natured person, but she didn't think deeply about issues. She didn't talk politics much. She would, you know, her politics, she'd be like, oh, that man is terrible, or, oh, those people. Yeah. And that would be like the end of it. With my siblings, boy, I have one brother's passed away, but I have two brothers, two sisters. One sister in particular definitely leans very left. You know, she's an academic, so I feel like if you just say academic, whatever you're picturing, yes, that's her politics. My older brother, who passed away quite a while ago, I am currently doing a memoir about him. Hmm. I'm writing a memoir about our relationship.
Is it cartoon or is it prose?
Yeah, it's going to be a comic memoir. Which is extreme. It's something I've been considering doing for years, but it's really difficult to do just because he is my brother, mm-hmm. and he was flawed in many ways. And I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. Mm-hmm. And some of my siblings are unhappy about that. So this is a difficult project I'm taking on. But working on it reminded me of when my brother and I would talk politics. My brother had a tendency to look at things at morally black and white. Like, I can remember we once had a conversation where he said, if something bad happens, it's always somebody's fault. Hmm. You know, and I'd be like, you mean like a hurricane, spilt milk? He was, yes, somebody, I think he was like blaming our little brother for something that was a total accident. And he goes, yeah, that was Tony's fault. I'm like, how is that his fault? It was an accident. He goes, when something bad happens, it's somebody's fault.
Wow.
And yeah, I was just stunned that he or anybody perceived the world this way. And he always had a weakness for, well, I would call it a weakness, for totalitarian leaders. Hmm. Like, I remember would be in the comic. I can remember we were going to a party and there was going to be a bunch of hippies there. It was these guys that it was like a real hippie party out in the woods. And my brother brought with him as an icebreaker, he brought Chairman Mao's little red book.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't know that much about him. I was like, he's a bad guy. You're reading a book about a bad, written by a bad man. My brother's like, he's got a lot of good ideas. You got to read this. Yeah. He's got good ideas. He obviously thought this book would impress. And I can remember as soon as we got to the party, there was this hippie guy that we didn't know, older than us. And he goes, is that the little red book? And my brother goes, yeah. And he goes, and this guy just goes, do you know that that man has murdered more people than anybody else in human history? And my brother's like, gulp. But then later on through life, and I could never tell if it was or to what extent it was tongue in cheek. But then he'd go through a phase where he loved Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin or Castro. Those are his boys. Yeah. He always, you know, so some might be fascists, some might be communists, right. But he would admire all of them. He liked the idea of a strong man who's going to fix all the problems.
Yeah. Well,
it doesn't matter. And at what human cost, it doesn't matter. Yeah. And I know. Sometimes I think most people are like that.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going around right now, right? I mean,
yes.
So now, what of your early professional kind of relationships was, speaking of, you know, of political people, was with Robert Crumb, arguably he's the, Leonardo da Vinci of underground comics and whatnot. And he was a man of the left. Can you talk or describe your relationship with Crumb and how did you guys talk about politics, or could you even?
Well, personally and professionally, I had a great relationship with him. He acted as a wonderful mentor towards me, mm-hmm. and would just give me very sage advice, philosophical advice, I guess you could call it, just to the extent of being an artist. And
an example of a bit of advice that you still are turning over?
It would always boil down to, these will sound like platitudes, mm-hmm. but it'd be circumstances that would lead to it, where it basically was be true to yourself, mm-hmm. and always think of your real audience is yourself, and that's the only person you're guaranteed to please. So just always focus on writing and drawing work that means something to you, even if it's just cathartic, mm-hmm. you know, even if you're being self-indulgent, just work for you and hopefully people will follow. But you're just chasing your tail if you're deliberately trying to appeal to other people, certain other people. Mm-hmm. So as far as politics go, well, I once asked him, since I could never tell, I just said, "What are your politics, Bob? What do you believe?" And I remember he answered, "I believe in a communist dictatorship with me as the dictator."
So you know, that kind of comes through in his work.
Yes.
What, you know, and obviously you're a generation. I mean, you're kind of the child of the R. Crumb generation, as well as maybe people like Art Spiegelman and whatnot. But what is it like to comics, you know, and I don't even know if like comics, like mainstream comics or alternative or underground comics, were held in like lower esteem. But what was it like for these guys or for yourself, like in the 80s, you know, kind of when you start to emerge as a professional cartoonist? You know, this was not a celebrated art form. It was not taken seriously. There were some people who did, but, you know, it was small. And now it's like, you know, the medium that you work in is absolutely serious in all of its permutations. What was it like to go through that kind of transition?
Well, probably more than anybody else, the person that led the charge to both through his own work and through his own efforts to make comics, particularly underground or alternative comics, mm-hmm. respectable and accepted, was Art Spiegel.
Right.
That was his big mission in life, was comics are art and people need to view comics as art.
And then his masterwork or the book that kind of made that happen was Mouse, a graphic novel about the Holocaust, featuring mice and rats as characters.
Right. And also at the same time, him and his wife, Francois, was editing a magazine called Raw. Mm-hmm. And Raw was, they had grand production values and it very deliberately combined aesthetics and traditions from the comic world with those of the fine art world. Mm-hmm. And so it was almost like it was specifically designed to get people from the fine art world to accept comics and to consider cartoonists artists just like they are. Crumb that had a different attitude than Spiegelman, which is why he started like a competing publication called Weirdo,
right,
that for a while helped him edit. Mm-hmm. Where Weirdo almost like the whole point was to wallow in the gutter.
No, because such that, a, I like you. You know, you don't really hear the word weirdo anymore. I mean, there was a punk band called the Weirdos. There was Weirdo the magazine, and like, you know, you always had a friend who was the weirdo, and it's just kind of, you know, it's a sense of, you know, because in a way, and I know you've even done some strips about this, but you know, like the weirdos took over, right? Like we're all weirdos now, so nobody's a weirdo.
You know, when you brought this up, that's exactly what I was thinking. It's like everybody's a weirdo now. Look, these politicians were talking about, you know, what a bunch of weirdos. And celebrated for it. So, yeah, I guess the word is redundant now. You don't need it
so
anymore.
So do you feel like and I realize at the same time that the kind of milieu and the medium that you work in is more respectable now and it has a bigger market on a certain level. Does that mean you're getting richer or is it
totally
independent because there have been so many other technological innovations where it's like, well, you know, Peter, you have respect now, but you're still not getting any cash.
No, and that's the problem too. Well, the business issue in this field is it's part of the print medium, and like including regular street publishing, comics are going through a really rough time just because everybody just reads stuff all day long for free on the internet.
Right.
So you're competing. That's the competition is free. That's what you're really competing with. And yeah, there are web cartoons. And for example, Reason will eventually post all my contributions.
Right.
On the web, where it's seen by way more people than see it in the actual magazine. But yeah, that is why it's still something of a financial struggle for a lot of cartoons, especially a lot of cartoonists my age, including me, it's like it having such a hard time maintaining a steady income stream that I always wonder why all these young people are becoming cartoonists. When you go to comic conventions, there's more cartoonists than ever. There's an ocean of them. All these conventions are massive now.
Right.
And you see all these young cartoonists who are paying for their own booths, paid for their transportation to get there from wherever they were from. I cannot fathom how it's worth their while. Or if
they got a song in their heart, they've got a cartoon in their hand, right? I mean, they want to express themselves, I guess.
Yes, I guess, but I don't know. I don't know how they do it. But anyhow, to go back to what you're talking about with comics being respectable, I was not against what Spiegelman was trying to do. It's not like I viewed it as either or, but I agreed with Crumb and some other people that as long as comics aren't taken seriously, it's very liberating. You can do whatever you want. Since nobody's taking it seriously, it's like you're having a party in the basement, you know, and just don't make too much noise and you can do what you want. And we were. And it was the work that we did then was far more irreverent and politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. It's did tons of things that nobody would dream of doing now.
No, it's kind of fascinating to think about somebody like Crumb, who even in his heyday and at the height of kind of like, you know, hippiedom and whatnot, he crossed lines that people were uncomfortable with. But so much of his work seems almost completely unimaginable now just because of the sexual politics of things.
Yeah. And there always were. He always had loud critics of his work for that very reason. But now they're louder than ever, like generalizing, but younger people in the comic world, millennials, he is just the worst. they talk about him like he's a monster.
Oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense, right? I mean, he's like D.W. Griffith or something. Like he might have been technically brilliant or something or invented a lot of stuff, but you gotta stop watching those movies, right?
Right. But anyhow, over time, comics did, like you said, comics did get taken more seriously. But I noticed that it made people, artists, more self-conscious. Mm. They were pandering in a way that they didn't used to. And in ways that it seemed to me like they weren't even aware of it. You know, everything got, for lack of a better word, I just noticed things getting gentler. The art and the content, it just, everything got softer and gentler. Don't ruffle feathers, you know, don't upset grandma because now she might see it. And what was interesting about that is I went to see about 5 or so years ago, I went to see Art Spiegelman give a talk. He was in Seattle at the library giving this talk. And what was interesting about it is he said, Way back when, I led the charge to make comics be taken seriously as art. I succeeded. Not like he did it all by himself, but he says, I succeeded in that mission. Comics are now taken seriously as an art form. But then it speaking goes, you know, but now I got to be honest, I miss when we all were flying the radar and we could, you know, it was like when nobody was paying attention, it was, we were having so much more fun and it was loosey goosey and you're actually, it was freeing. And when he said that, I almost jumped on the stage and strangled him.
You know, one of the most interesting, I think, developments of your work, speaking of kind of serious work, and, you know, and it's interesting to me when I read your stuff, it's all like, it's, you know, it's comic, like literally, they're comics, but it's also, there's a comic sensibility to it. There, you know, there's laughs to be had, even when you're talking about serious stuff, but you do intellectually serious stuff, and you've published these heavily researched, you know, book-length biographies of people who mentioned Margaret Sanger and Zora Neale Hurston. And you're working on one, or one is about to be published on Rose Wilder Lane. Two questions. First, what do you find powerful about that medium of, you know, a graphic novel biography of Margaret Sanger, the great birth control apostle, or Zora Neale Hurston, a phenomenal figure of the Harlem Renaissance who had a tragic life, and Rose Wilder Lane. But what's that format like? And then I want to ask you about Rose Wilder Lane in particular, some questions about why her. But
well, first and foremost, I'm doing comics or graphic novels about these people simply because I am a cartoonist. It's my chosen medium, and it's something I know how to do. Spent my entire adult life, you know, honing this craft. So I might as well, if I'm inspired to write about Margaret Sanger or Rose Wilder Lane, it just seems like the obvious way to go. It's also the way I perceive things. And these three women that you just mentioned, these three women that I did biographical comics about, when I would read biographies about them, or even like with Lane and Hurston, who are fiction writers, when I read their fiction, their stories to me are very visual. I could easily picture them as comic strips. These women all had larger than life personalities. They were all, in some ways, you could describe all three of them to various degrees as crazy. they took crazy risks with their lives and their health just to pursue whatever ambitions or dreams they had. And it was lively. They basically spent most of their lives writing. But there's a lot of writers where if you did a comic about them, it'd be panel after panel of somebody sitting behind a typewriter, you know, smoking a pipe. These women also were out and about. Yeah. They led very adventurous, wild, crazy lives and get arrested, you know, all kinds of. So they gave me a lot to draw. There was an awful lot to draw with them.
So talk about Lane, Rose Wilder Lane. I suspect that many of our people in our audience know who she is, kind of, but she's the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who is famous for the Little House books. But what is, you know, why should we care about Rose Wilder Lane, you know, in the 21st century, right? It's like 2019, I think. You know, why is Lane's life relevant to us now?
Well, what inspired me to learn more about her was in Daugherty's book.
Brian Daugherty's Radicals for Capitalism,
Yes. When I read about her, I was like, this woman didn't just talk the talk. She walked the walk. She was to protest food rationing during World War II. She grew literally all of her own food. And then there were other examples of her taking these extremes in her life just to make a point. She used to, she would deliberately stay, she'd keep her income below the poverty line to avoid paying income tax. So she would turn down paying work if it would pop her up, her income up enough that she'd have to pay even 1 cent of income tax. She was against. So she was poor on purpose, which was something that actually J. Edgar Hoover found unfathomable when she wound up having, even though she was the world's biggest commie hater, passionate commie hater, they still had FBI had a 100-page file on her.
Of course, she was a journalist and a writer and a polemicist who's like super anti-communist. So of course the FBI is going to be on her case, right?
Well, what they would focus on, what they'd stick with, was she once wrote an article, and it was an anti-communist article, but she wrote an article called How I Almost Joined the Communist Party. And it's a crazy story. It's a funny story. It's pretty much her meeting John Reed.
Yeah. The 10 days that shook the world. The figure in Warren Beatty's Reds movie.
Yes. And she, and the way she writes it, she seemed like she was like sexually enamored with him. She describes while he was talking about, you know, the Russian Revolution and et cetera, et cetera. She seemed like she was falling. It wasn't just his words, but him that she was falling prey to. And she also said, it's very funny, but she also said it was the combination of his irresistible charm plus the fact that she was coming down with the flu that made her almost put her pen to paper and join the Communist Party. But then her fever broke and she was like, I'm glad I didn't. But that's just it. The FBI had, part of the reason they had a file on her is because she wrote an article that was called I Almost Joined the Communist Party. Now, they obviously didn't read it.
So what was her role? You mentioned Brian Dougherty's Radicals for Capitalism, which is a history of the kind of modern libertarian movement. It's a fantastic book that everybody who has any interest in 20th century America should read, but especially libertarians. Rose Wilder Lane, along with Isabel Patterson and Ayn Rand, are kind of the three, you know, the three women who kind of created the modern libertarian movement in many ways, or the sensibility. What was Lane's relationship with Laura Ingalls Wilder, her mother?
She was an only child, and both women were extremely intelligent, talented, and extremely opinionated and very stubborn. So it's not hard to imagine they argued a lot. They had these very usually extremely passive-aggressive arguments. It must have been torture for somebody to witness the two of them.
For like Almanzo or whatever, the dad Pa Ingalls must have been like, I'm going to go out and hope to get scalped by Indians or something. Yeah,
yeah. No, he spent a lot of time in the community.
In the smokehouse.
Yeah, just doing anything, especially his wife, you know, he was...
Rose, she encouraged her mother to write her memories, right, of growing up on what was then the frontier.
Well, her mother already was writing. Mm-hmm. Rose was already a professional writer out in California. She moved out to California with her husband. Then the two became estranged, then divorced. But she, in the meantime, worked for a San Francisco newspaper and wrote all kinds of things. She herself was writing these biographies on celebrities of the time, Jack London and Charlie Chaplin, where she took huge liberties with the facts. Basically, they were very fictionalized biographies. But anyhow, her mother started writing, Laura Ingalls Wilder started writing an advice column for farmers' wives for a publication called the Missouri Ruralist. And then when the Depression, let me back up a little bit. Laura Ingalls Wilder, she always did want to write about her childhood and her past and her family, was never quite sure how to do it, what format to take. You know, she would take baby steps in this direction. What happened was, Rose was living with her parents again in the late 20s and early 30s. The Depression hit. It wiped out their savings. They were desperate for new income sources. So Laura finally was like, I've got to do this. Just if only to make money, I've got to sit down and write this book. And she did write something called Pioneer Girl that got rejected. But it was mainly – for the most part, everything that Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote and sent in by herself would get rejected. And then Rose would go over it. Her daughter would go over it, and then it'd be accepted. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like everything she wrote, just for it to get published, everything had to go through the Rose Wilder Lane editing machine. And they started out having huge fights about all this. Her mother was like a real stickler for the facts. And, you know, and Lane had to explain, you know, facts can be really boring. You know, if you stick with the truth of that religiously, you know, you're just going to bore everybody to tears. So they used to have huge fights. But after a while, and Laura Ingalls Wilder also resented it. She resented having her daughter go through everything just to have it published. But then she got used to it, and she also got used to all the money that started rolling in because it was these books were a huge hit right out of the gate. Far more successful in the long run than anything Rose Lane wrote by herself. But Rose Lane in the 30s, in the 20s and 30s, she herself was a best-selling author, both of novels and short stories and nonfiction pieces. She was one of the highest-paid writers in America in the 20s and 30s. But her own work has largely been forgotten, at least compared to her mother.
What? And she closed out her life, or near, I mean, she lived, what, into the 70s? Is that right? Into the 1970s or late 60s?
She died in 1968.
Yeah,
and she was in her early 80s.
But she actually, didn't she cover Vietnam, the Vietnam War?
Yes. It was interesting. She had a great supporter and mentor in this woman. Now I can't remember. Helen Teague. Her last name was Teague or Tighe. T-I-G-H-E. And she was the editor of Women's Day magazine. And Women's Day magazine started in the late 30s. And basically, this woman's attitude towards Lane is, whatever you want to write for us, I'll publish it. So most of what she wrote was knitting advice, needlework.
Wow.
She has her all-time best-selling book, Lane's, is a book, the Women's Day book on American needlework, which is, it's a huge hit mainly because it's mostly instructional. Mm-hmm. And she has a, she writes articles in it, Lane does, talking about the political history and the political ramifications of a lot of these styles and traditions, mm-hmm. which a lot of, what do I know? I'm not an expert on the history of needlework. People who are say that at the very least, she really exaggerated, for example, the difference between American and European mm-hmm. needlepoint styles, with her saying it has to do with American traditions and liberty and freedom.
Right.
And that's why we make so ducks looking this way.
I would like to think that crocheting, with knowing nothing about this, that crocheting is the true libertarian, skill there. But
So even if you look at like Goodreads uh-huh. and read reviews of Rose Lane's needlepoint book, the reviews mostly are, this book is a great resource. It teaches you how to do every kind of needlepoint, how to do every kind of stitch. They go, but this woman who wrote it, she writes these articles, I don't know what she's talking about.
What was her
What
was her take on Vietnam? Was she in favor of, I could see being an anti-communist, I could see, being in favor of the Vietnam War, but I could also see it being like, what the hell are we doing there?
Well, in my book that's coming out, I touch on that. And we hadn't gone all in yet. She went in 1965, so it was a year before they started drafting people
right.
and shipping them there. So it was just, when she was there, there were military advisors, and she talked to a lot of NGOs and talked a lot to the Vietnamese themselves. And she, of course, she very much supported the South Vietnamese in their fight against the Viet Cong. And she was very receptive to all the horror stories she was being told about the Viet Cong. So she was all in morally, mm-hmm. For the cause of South Vietnam. She didn't spend a huge amount of time there. And so in retrospect, something that she was, I think it's unfair to say she was willfully unaware of it, but she was unaware of how corrupt the South Vietnamese government was mm-hmm. and how that ultimately was going to do them in and do their cause in. She didn't, at once we started drafting soldiers and shipping them there, I haven't come across anything written by her where she talked about that, mm-hmm. but I'm sure she was against that simply because she was opposed to the draft.
Right. And was she a conscientious objector during World War II, or was she just mad at the government kind of rationing?
She knew that she was completely against going to war, and specifically for Women's Day. She wrote a lot of articles urging people not to get suckered into this European war, to repeat what we did with World War I. And she would remind the readers of all the reasons why we should not get involved with this war, in spite of the atrocities that are happening over there, because she would point out that atrocities are always happening everywhere, but, war is not the solution. She dropped all that after Pearl Harbor mm-hmm. just because after Pearl Harbor, she's like, well, we're at war.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do to say. We're just simply at war. You know, the Japanese solved the problem for
right,
us.
Right,
right. They ended the debate for us.
Yeah, and Germany declared war on us before we did, on them. So.
Yes. And she also, as soon as that war started, she also was, she was a real patriot too. She had, she, like all libertarians, she had tremendous faith in people, mm-hmm. Whether people as individuals or also people, you know, preferably voluntarily working as groups. And she particularly had faith in America because she lived during the time where America was the driving force for all this technology that made life so much simpler and easier and more interesting. So once, even though there was lots of hand wringing by people in the country about like, oh, we're not ready, we're not geared up for war yet, her attitude was, we're going to get ready, we're going to collaborate with these people. She had no doubt that we were going to just crush Japan and Germany. She never sweated it for a second. She was like, I've been to Germany, and she just knew how for the Germans, the war was unsustainable, that they couldn't win, that they were on a fool's errand. Basically, they just repeated all the mistakes they made after World War One.
What, you know, when you are writing kind of, you know, there are comic books or series that you've done like Hate, Apocalypse, Nerd, the graphic novel, Other Lives, that are more kind of, you know, they're narrative, they're funny. I mean, they're, you know, there's that. And then there's kind of the political or, you know, and I'm using air quotes here, and but like serious work. Do, you know, does that change the way that you approach things? Or like, I mean, do you tighten up when you're doing like the serioso work?
By serioso, I guess you mean the work I do.
The Lane books. Yeah.
And what I do for reason.
Yeah.
I make a point. I'm very serious about when I'm researching it and cobbling together a story and trying to come up with a narrative thread that will sustain the reader. But then when it comes down to breaking it down into individual pages and drawing it, then I force myself to loosen up, to just go nuts and be myself, basically. I'll be doing that while I have this very solid foundation of facts and information. And that's all good to go. That's all set up. And I feel comfortable that I know what I'm talking about. It's much easier because you don't have to do the research to do those graphic novels that you talked about, like Reset and Other Lives, because I'm not writing about somebody else's life, and I don't have this pile of other biographies teetering next to me.
Is there a difference between working for kind of independent publishers or smaller publishers, say like Reason, and, you know, you've worked for DC Comics, you've worked for Marvel. Does that change, you know, the kind of the size of the corporate entity with which you're exchanging, you know, work for money? Does that change things?
A little bit. Working for Marvel and DC, you just know going in that there's things you can't do or say. You know there's going to be a lot of rules when you're working with a licensed character. Like I did a one-shot Hulk comic and a one-shot Spider-Man comic. So I knew that I couldn't literally do whatever the heck I wanted with these characters.
What was the thing you wanted to do to the Hulk that you knew you were not going to be able to?
Well, originally it was just simply... he was taking drugs. I had the Hulk taking antidepressants and I had Bruce Banner, his alter ego, taking Viagra. And I was trying to make this hot mess of this guy who already is a mess.
Yeah.
Who's Jekyll and Hyde, and what would happen if he takes all these pills? Because of course, when Bruce Banner takes Viagra, the Viagra is also going to be inside the Hulk.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's kind of... His pants get ripped now, you know, when he changes.
The problem was... originally, when I did the Spider-Man comic, which came out first, and then when I started doing the Hulk comic, and the script was totally approved, and I had most of the art done, Marvel changed ownership. They used to be owned by a guy named Perlman, who I think owned Revlon.
Yep. Yeah, Ron Perlman.
He's a Wall Street guy, bought and sold shit. And Marvel, before all these movies started, Marvel was really struggling. So that's why they were allowing me and other artists who normally they would never go hiring. Right. They're just basically they said, let's just throw shit at the wall and see what sticks. Mm-hmm. And so they gave me a shocking amount of freedom with the Spider-Man book. It was the same with the Hulk book, but the new owners, I can't remember their name, the people who bought it from Perlman, they were really uptight. They really perceived everything as being kid friendly, even if the writers and artists were not thinking about little kids right. at all. This new company whose name I can't remember. The main reason they bought Marvel is for the character rights to put on Underoos. I think they made Underoos. So because they made Underoos, they thought a lot about, you know, is this kid friendly?
Yeah.
And they totally freaked out when they saw my Hulk book with, you know, the antidepressants. Even though it was all legal drugs. It was all perfect.
He had prescriptions.
Yes. It was all prescription drugs, but I couldn't use, they didn't want me to use the word drug.
Could Dr. Bruce Banner, could he write his own scripts? I don't know. He's not really an MD, right? He's a research scientist, a chemist or whatever. But
we thought it was hilarious. My editor thought it was ridiculous too. It's like, these are legal drugs are a thing. What do you mean you can't use the word drugs? That's like saying you can't use the word trees. Yeah. You know, it's a thing that exists and that everybody takes. They were adamant about it. This had us briefly in a panic because it's like, do we have to write a whole new script? Do we have to come up with a whole new story? But I just said, what if instead of drugs, we use the word serum? and so we ran, I said, can we use the word to the under? We said, can we use the word serum? And they said, yeah, sure, that's fine.
So super soldier drugs, that's bad. Super soldier serum, that's Captain America. So just to end, I want to ask, because one of your great in your entire oeuvre, like one of my favorite things was an early web video series that you did with, I believe it was Dana Gould, the comedian, about Murray Wilson, the father of the Beach Boys. Right. Is that, describe what that is, and then is it available online anywhere?
Oh, yeah, okay. It's easy to find. You can find it on YouTube easily. Okay. Yeah, so it was Murray Wilson, Rock and Roll Dad. And Murray spelled his first name M-U-R-R-Y. Right. What happened? Two things happened at the same time. One was both Dana and I was talking to Dana Gould on the phone, and we just watched a docudrama about the Beach Boys. And we both just couldn't stop laughing about the actor. And it turns out Dana was friends with the actor. We just kept cracking up about the actor who played Murray Wilson and also Murray Wilson's character and personality. Reading, you know, Dana's like me, he's a big Beach Boy fan. And everything that you read about Murray Wilson is slapping your head. The guy is just...
Because he's like the ultimate stage dad, right? Like, and he beat his children until they sang like angels. And he had a glass eye.
Yeah. So we just, you know, he's a cranky old man. And to both me and Dan, a cranky old man are always funny. So then this company that was short-lived... .com popped up called Icebox, and they were just going to, it's going to be all animation free on the internet. They asked me if I wanted to do a cartoon, or Dana, I can't remember which one of them they asked, but they wanted to, they made a point of combining a cartoonist with a established Hollywood writer, mm-hmm. which Dana of course is. So, we only entertained one idea, and that was doing a cartoon show about Murray Wilson, just because at the time that was the one thing that was cracking us
and
up.
And Murray, Murray Wilson got kind of kicked out of the Beach Boys, right? Like, or they left him behind, and then the running gag of the show is that he's bringing in new acts that to show that he's the genius. Yeah.
It's all true. They fired, fired Murray, and he started had a group called the Sun Rays.
So is this a sub theme of your work? So it's like Murray Wilson is like Laura Ingalls Wilder, but he gets fired by his more successful daughter. And then it's like, you know, this is you all along, you wanted to fire your parents or whatever, but
right.
you never got.
Well, to be fair, Laura Ingalls Wilder had a lot more to offer than Murray ever did. There's a, I have a friend, his name is George Faulkner, and he just indulges himself with, he makes these records with professional musicians, and he has been trying to collect every song that Murray wrote that either he recorded himself, because he did wind up making an album, The Many Moods of Murray Wilson. But going all the way back to
The Many Moods, it's like Rage 1, Rage 2, Anger, yes. The Anger Suite. I mean, like, had a screaming at my son in the studio. Right. Yeah, there weren't a lot of moods to Murray Wilson. There's like one.
He wrote really, really corny songs in the 1950s that he sold and were recorded. He did understand the music publishing industry because he went into it, and his songs were ridiculously corny. It's amazing that anybody recorded it. But of course, we're talking about the era of like the three haircuts and how much is that.
Where all you needed was a crew cut and a cardigan, and you had a number one hit somehow.
And there was one song written by three, I can't remember what they were called, the Bachelors or something. And the song went, and it was country tinged, and it went, I'm going back to Texas. And the name of the song is Texas. And apparently he went to the this musician I'm talking about. He looked into the Library of Congress's archives and found like 40 songs that Murray Wilson had published that nobody had ever recorded. And one song was written like in 1951 or 52. And it said in the credits, it said written by Murray Wilson and Mike Love. Now, Mike Love was Murray Wilson's nephew.
Right.
And he would have been 10. So he was collaborating with a 10-year-old Mike Love.
Although, given how litigious Mike Love is, maybe he went back in and had his name added to the songwriting credit after the fact. Isn't that that's basically how he's been living for the past 20 years?
Yeah. Well, one thing something that's always been true of Mike Love is he's got a nose for money.
Oh, yeah. No, that guy's a real truffle hound.
So he is a troublehound, and I'm sure that when he saw what his uncle was up to, he goes, really, you're writing these songs, and then you're sending, somebody might record it, and you'll make money? Oh, that's the plan, nephew. It's like, let me help you. Basically did with Murray what he wound up getting rich doing with his cousin.
Well, we are going to leave it there because you really can't top Murray Wilson or Mike Love. But we've been talking with Peter Bagg, the great cartoonist whose most recent work is on display in the current issue of Reason, Immigration Grunts, the Poor Slobs Who Try to Help the Poor Slobs Trapped in Detention Hell. He's got a book-length graphic novel about Rose Wilder Lane coming out in a month. Peter, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I have been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason, wherever you listen. And thanks for listening.